It's time for another edition of On Your Money. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And today, financial planner Kevin McKinley will talk about the rising cost of raising kids from birth to college. He'll also talk about some factors to consider before you buy a home for your golden years. And we'll get some advice on whether our next car should be a new one or a used one. Plus, we'll have plenty of time for your personal finance questions at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Kevin McKinley is a certified financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money, LLC. He joins us from our studios in Eau Claire. Hello, Kevin.
Hello, Joy.
It is so good to talk to you. Once again, I had a nice staycation during the last couple of weeks of June, and then you were gone last week on vacation. I hope you had a nice one.
I had a workcation.
You had a workcation.
Yes, I did. It was meant I just went to work every day, but I'm not complaining. Glad to have a job. Glad to have an income. So,
yeah, you'd be proud of me, Kevin. On my staycation, I did a lot of work too, personal finance work. I looked into long-term care insurance. I refinanced. I also finished up my estate planning and my will stuff. So, do I get a gold star?
You do get the official On Your Money gold star. Did you just go back and listen to every single one of the On Your Money archives?
How did you know?
I did. No better way to spend $300 or $400.
Well, listen, it was a nice break, but it is good to be back and good to get some more advice from you. I understand that you have some facts and figures regarding kids and the cost of raising kids. With students being now in the middle of their summer vacation, it seems like a good time to discuss this. Where do you want to start?
Well, let's start with college savings. According to a survey entitled How America Saves for College from Sallie Mae, only half of families are actually saving money for college. That compares to about 60% of families surveyed 2 years ago. So obviously, a lot of families out there are putting higher priority on more immediate concerns. The average amount saved depends on the kid's age, but typically if it's a toddler, those who have saved have put aside about $5,000. Tweens, their parents have put aside about $10,000, and teenagers have accumulated about $15,000 for college costs. It sounds like bad news in terms of those dollar amounts if you've heard how much college is costing, but it's actually good news because according to our bucket strategy of paying for college, that $15,000 should come fairly close to covering the first year of college. And rather than try to accumulate several hundred thousand dollars before a kid turns 18, it's better off to do what you can, which is to pay for that first year out of savings and then pay for another year out of income over 48 months. Typically works out to about $300 to $400 per month. That could be from the parent's income or earnings from the student. The student's willing to borrow some money, and he or she should be willing to borrow some money. They can graduate from college with a student loan of about $20,000 or so to pay for another year of college. And that's unfortunate, but still it's manageable with a payment of about $200 per month. They can pay off that student loan within 10 years. And then finally, the parent can borrow if they can and wish to. And again, it's about $200 a month over 10 years.
So what are parents spending now on their kids? Are parents spending more on their kids now rather than saving for the future college costs?
This is part of the problem here. The cost is definitely rising. According to the USDA, the cost of raising a child from birth to age 18 is at $235,000 for the most recent numbers. And that's up about $10,000 from the previous year's numbers. Now, that works out to about $1,100 a month or so. The biggest component of that cost, though, is paying for a bigger house to get an extra room. Mm. The other components are child care and education costs. So that's the good news, is it's fairly manageable if you look at it that way. The bad news is that figure does not include the cost of college. And generally, that $250,000 or so is tied to income in terms of how much families expend on a particular kid from birth to 18. It's about $212,000 for lower income families and up to $500,000 for upper income families.
So does that $235,000 include the amount of money we give our kids for allowance?
That's a small and manageable component, but according to a recent survey from the American Institute of CPAs, it's up to about $15 per week. And of course, that's higher with the child's age and the family income. I saw something on a website called The Simple Dollar, which I thought was a great idea, which I do like using an allowance and tying it to work. So there is some kind of buy-in from the kids to say, hey, you have to help out with the household duties here to get some of your money. But there was an article about putting up a job board to say, if you want 10 bucks, you have to mow the lawn. Or if you want $3, take out the garbage and let the kid choose in which jobs he or she wants to perform, and so that he or she can choose a particular dollar amount to and balance it out. And giving the kid some control over that choice sometimes means there's less headache, because you've said, hey, you chose this job, you're going to get this dollar amount of money, now quit complaining and finish it up.
Yeah, sir, do you have any advice on how we can save on that $235,000?
Well, one of the things that was interesting that came out of this a while ago from a website called Coupon Codes for You, they've conducted a survey on parents actually rating their kids' savings. And what they found is about half of parents admitted to taking money from the kids, and half of them feel guilty about it. Wow. The reasons were, you know, vacation or using it to pay bills or paying for things for the kid or to buy presents for the kids as well. And initially, that's kind of troubling. But in reality, you know, I don't want the rest of the family to starve to preserve what's in the right. kid's piggy bank. So I understand that. Where this can be an issue sometime, though, is if you were using money from a kid's actual savings or an investment account, like an UTMA account, and the kid is under the age of adulthood. And if you use that for something that is not for the benefit of the kid, above and beyond normal maintenance and support, the IRS doesn't like that. And so if you are going to pull that money out, you can pull it out, and sometimes you should for financial aid purposes or to make sure the kid doesn't pull it out once he or she reaches adulthood. But if you are going to pull it out, you should match it up with expenses that they might have, like, you know, if you're buying a car for an older kid or sending a kid to camp or paying for braces or sports camps or whatever. That's usually a legitimate excuse.
Well, I have to do some more homework, Kevin. No kiddos at my house. So what is an UTMA account?
An UTMA is a uniform transfer to minor account, basically. And it's a way that a parent or another adult can have control over the money, but that it's still tied to the kid's Social Security or tax ID number.
Kevin McKinley is the managing member of McKinley Money, LLC, a registered investment advisor with offices in Eau Claire and Madison. Kevin does not intend to provide personalized investment advice through this broadcast and does not represent that the securities or services discussed are suitable for any investor. You should consult with your own financial advisor prior to making any investment decisions. That being said, if you have a question for Kevin, we have an open line for you at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. And it is time now for the On Your Money email bag. A listener named Tom says, I am 66. How can I protect my assets from nursing home costs? I don't want to buy insurance. Thanks. What do you think, Kevin?
Well, I think that just by being off for a few weeks, we've really gone slack on what's required to get a question answered on the show. A mere thanks rather than false praise heaped on before and after the question. Well, Tom, that's our fault, so we'll take your question. But the rest of you out there, let's step it up a little
come
bit.
Come on, people.
His concerns are very understandable. Cost of aged care can range from a few thousand dollars a month for an assisted living facility up to $8,000 to $10,000 for someone who needs Alzheimer's or dementia care. The good news about that is only about 40% of people will probably need this care at all. And typically, the average stay can run anywhere from 6 months to a couple years or so. So if you're looking at the dollar amounts involved, it's still a ton of money. But it's kind of like paying for college or raising a child. You kind of pay as you go and deal with it what you can. There's some bad news and some good news, though, about Tom's question.
What's the bad news?
It's difficult to shelter assets and still maintain access to the money, especially easy money. You can give the money away to family members. You say they're going to get it anyway. Just as soon they get it than the nursing home. But once a person does go into a nursing home and applies for Medicaid, there's a 60-month look back. So they'll look back for your transactions for 5 years. And if they notice any money that you've given away over that 5 years, they'll probably make you pay for your services with that money before qualifying for Medicaid. You can set up an asset protection trust and put the money into that. But again, it really becomes very restrictive to get the money if you need it before you actually go into the nursing home. And it can be very complex and very expensive to not only set up, but also maintain as well. Typically, it's better off to use your cash to say, hey, I want this money here so that I can pay for the best care for myself or my loved ones as possible than it is to try to rely on Medicaid from the get-go that you may never need.
But Medicaid is still there, right?
Yeah, that's the good news, and it is there for now. I'm guessing that as time goes on, it will become more difficult and the funds will become less available. But you must spend down all of your assets, down to about $2,000 or so, before you can qualify for Medicaid. If there's a surviving spouse or a spouse who's still staying at home, it may be possible to keep the home. But if it's just an individual, and the individual is widowed or divorced or single, and he or she goes into a nursing home and has a house, the good news is they may be able to keep the house and still qualify for Medicaid. The bad news is if the patient passes away while under Medicaid payment, the system may actually go back after the home proceeds once it's sold to replenish the funds that were used. Now, the better news about this, though, is that keep in mind, if the person is alive, he or she is getting the Social Security and pension checks that that she's normally getting anyway. So that can help offset this cost of assisted living or a nursing home facility.
All right. Let's say Tom changes his mind and decides he would rather purchase long-term care insurance. What should he keep in mind?
It's a good idea if it makes him feel better, if he says, good, I've got this policy in place right now. And it's typically best for people who have more than $200,000 in liquid assets, that's paper, and less than $2 million. Anything less than that, they probably can't afford the premiums out of their bigger picture. And anything more than $2 million, they can probably get a better deal just by paying for it out of pocket. 1 month's premium typically buys 1 day of care for 3 years. So if you're looking to get a policy that pays $200 per day for 3 years, it's probably going to cost you about $200 per month. But again, that can depend on your situation and the type of policy and the insurance company. But many companies who have been offering this are either getting out of the business altogether or they're locking down and not taking on any new policy purchasers. So keep in mind, if you are doing this, don't do it if you're 60 years old and say, I want to do this so that when I'm 85 and I need this money, this company and this policy will be there to pay for it. Do it because it's almost like a 30-day proposition, meaning you buy it today, pay the premium today, and in 30 days there's a new premium due. If you still need it, you still want it, and you can afford the premium, then you pay it. So do it on more of a month-to-month basis rather than over long decades.
Sounds good. Thanks to Tom for that email. If you have a question that you would like to email, send it to onyourmoney@wpr.org. If you have a question that you would like to ask Kevin McKinley right now, you can call 1-800-642-1234. This is On Your Money. I'm Joy Cardine with financial planner Kevin McKinley, and our first caller is Beatrice in Port Washington. Good morning.
Morning. I have a question about a college. I have two kids, and one, she's already a freshman in college, and the other one is a junior in high school. And my husband and I, we had two accounts, a Vanguard account, a 529. And as the market, as you know, has been going up and down, we have really very little money there. It's about $9,000 for each. And what I saw is to wait until they are out of college. Right now, they have some tuition help with a scholarship. I am a widow now, and so we had some financial aid. And I saw to wait until they are done and with the payments are due. I know they have 6 months grace to pay, start paying. Then use the money, so let it grow in the account, and then get it out when they finish so they can pay or lower their college debt. Is that a good idea, or how should I invest this money? I remember listening on the radio that you said that the money in the bank card slows down as the kids reach the college age. Can I call them back in a bank card and ask them to invest a little more? Put more risk on it, or
thanks,
what can I
Beatrice.
Do?
Beatrice. Sure. Beatrice, great questions, and let me make sure I understand this. You're asking if, rather than pulling money out of a 529 for kids who are in school right now, if you can wait till they're out of school and then pull the money out to pay off any student loans that they have, correct?
Yes, They're correct, yes.
Okay, and then when it comes to the investment, you want to know if you can call Vanguard up and say, can you change the allocation, correct?
Right.
Okay. Answer to your first question is you can do that. The bad news is withdrawals from 529 accounts are not qualified for the tax exemption on the profits. Now, that's the bad news, meaning that if you pull it out afterwards and use the money to pay off loans, you won't get a tax exemption. The good news is, Beatrice, the tax will only be applied to the earnings portion of the account. So let's say you put in $8,000 and it's worth $9,000 and then you pull it back out. You'll only pay taxes and penalties on the $1,000 of profit, not the whole $9,000. And if you're qualifying for financial aid, I'm guessing you're probably in a relatively low income tax bracket. So the income tax can be little or nothing, especially if you do choose to actually gift the account to the child and let your kids cash it out to pay it off. So they'll only pay a penalty that might run about 10% of the profit. So the good news is you can do that. The bad news is that you can't get the tax break on it. So you might be better off just pulling it out and paying the taxes and penalties on the profits if there are any. And then you also might want to pull it out and pay for the final years of expenses if there's anything that's out of pocket for the kids at that time. Or you might just leave it in there because if they're going on to grad school or med school or to get an MBA or something, then you can pull it out at that time to cover any difference that they get with the financial aid. And then to answer your question about the asset allocation, yes, it typically, if it's in an age-based allocation in a 529 plan, it typically grows more conservative as a child gets older, meaning it becomes more bonds and cash than stocks. But that doesn't mean it can't go down in value. So you may want to look at just calling Vanguard up, and if it's possible, say, could you just move this into a money market account so the money doesn't go up at all, but it doesn't go down at all either.
Thanks very much, Beatrice, for the call. Coming up on this edition of On Your Money, Kevin will have some things we should keep in mind before buying a home in our golden years and advice on whether we should buy a used or a new car. And more answers to your personal finance questions at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Go on, take the money and run. Go on, take the money and run. This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine along with personal finance advisor Kevin McKinley. And let's go back to the phones. Dick in Cumberland is with us next. Hi, Dick.
Hi. I just recently retired, and I have 5 grandchildren that I'd like to do something for college expenses to help kind of cut that amount down. The kids are 8 and under. What's the best vehicle that I could look at to try and put a good chunk of money away for them so that they've got some monies in the bank to use when college comes?
Very noble gesture, Dick, and congratulations, especially when you are on the cusp of retirement, because mm-hmm. most of the people I work with in my grown-up job are in the same situation, and it's a time of great anxiety in many cases. So good for you that you're not only in that situation, but you have the confidence that you can still do this. And one way to do this, Dick, in a way that allows you to maintain control over the money, but also get some tax advantage for it, is to set up one of those aforementioned 529 accounts. And you can use one from any state, for any kid in any state, for any school in any state, and even worldwide if it's an accredited institution. But the EdVest program will give you a small tax break when you make those initial deposits, and it's about up to $3,000 per deposit per beneficiary each year. So you could put in $250 a month for each grandkid if you wanted, or you could just put a lump sum in as well. And there are several different investment options, much like when you were working, you probably had an at-work retirement plan that allowed you to pick from a menu of investments. Well, the EdVest program has that, and they do actually have even like a money market account and kind of a fixed rate account. Now, again, those won't pay very much, but they're much safer. A better way to go is, in my opinion anyway, are the age-based ones that the previous caller had, where those you can pick the asset allocation based on each grandchild's age in each separate account. And the best thing about that is, Dick, is that you maintain total control over the money. You can change it at any time. You can take it back. You can transfer it from one kid to another, or you can just cash it out and spend it on yourself if you want. But you will pay taxes and penalties on the earnings portion of it. If you just pull the money out and match it up against qualified higher education expenses, and that definition is fairly liberal, there's no taxes on it whatsoever.
Would it be better to do a monthly investment for the kids, or just a one lump sum every year, or whatnot? And I'm glad you mentioned that 529 accounts are the same for every state, because grandchildren are in three different states.
Yeah, and I would you do the 529 account, and again, if you do the EdVest, it's perfectly acceptable and reasonable to use it for a kid in a different state who might go to a school in a third state. And I'd prefer the dollar cost averaging, in part because of the way the investment world is right now, and also because of your situation. I wouldn't want you to put in, you know, $50,000 into these various plans and then say, oh, shoot, I wish I hadn't done that. I could either use the money somewhere else, or these kids never come up and visit Grandpa Dick in Cumberland, and so I don't want them to get the money.
Your grandkids are very fortunate, Dick. Thanks very much for the call. I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley, Certified Financial Planner, Managing Member of McKinley Money, LLC. Kevin is here with us with information and advice on your money just about every week. The live broadcast is Tuesday from 8 until 9 in the morning, and now the show, Kevin, is being rebroadcast on Sunday mornings from 7 until 8 a.m.
Oh, my
and
gosh.
And that's where the show first started, isn't it?
I cannot go back to getting up that early again. Do it. Well, anyway, do I have to be here for the rebroadcast?
No, the rebroadcast will play without your, you don't have to run the board for that, Kevin. So, but if you're listening to this on Sunday morning, it's a rebroadcast, but you can always email us onyourmoney@wpr.org, and Kevin might pick up your question for a future broadcast. If you have a question right now on Tuesday, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. John in Milwaukee is with us now. Hi, John.
Oh, hi. Hi, Joy. I need Kevin to decipher something for me, if you would. I got my Target Retirement 2010 IRA statement from Vanguard yesterday, and apparently this statement's been here before, and I must have overlooked it, but it says, beginning on January 1st, 2012, new tax rules on taxable mutual fund accounts require Vanguard to track cost basis information for shares acquired and subsequently sold on or after that date. Unless you select another method, sales of Vanguard mutual funds, but not ETFs, will default to the average cost method. They're going to begin reporting it in 2013. I don't know what that means. Could you just
say something? I was going to say, neither do I. What the heck are you talking about, John? So what does that mean, Kevin?
This could be a new segment on the show where people call up and read confusing prospectuses and notices from their financial institution. John, it's a very good question, and it is confusing. What it means is that for decades, if not the past century, cost basis reporting has practically been on the honor system. I've been a financial planner for 25 years and done this show for a long time. I've never heard of anyone who said, hey, the IRS called me. I told them I put down a price for something, for a stock or a bond or a mutual fund I sold, and they don't believe it's true, and now they're asking me to verify it. Well, they're going to start verifying that to help fill the tax gap, the $300-some billion that they believe is escaping the IRS because this information isn't being reported properly. Do you know the actual current cost basis, John, of those Vanguard funds?
You know, I sure don't. I've been pretty lax in contacting Vanguard. They offer me a lot of help. They even offer a free advisor, and I've been really lax in that. It's easier to stick your head in the sand if you don't understand this stuff. But I really should get more involved. I know it's stupid not to, but they seem to be doing a good job with my accounts, so I wasn't that worried about it, you know.
Sure, and where what happens is if and when you do go to sell the account, you do have to come up with the cost basis, and you do have to present something that's hopefully as close to the truth as possible. And in reality, the IRS technically says if you don't know what the cost basis of a particular share or investment purchase is, your new cost basis is zero, meaning you are technically subject to capital gains tax on the entire capital gain. Here's what I would do. I would contact Vanguard and say, I am trying to assemble what my cost basis is on these shares. What can you do to help me? And there's a good chance, has it been held at Vanguard the entire time?
Yes.
Okay, if it has, it's a good chance they have it all on record, and they might even send you your year-end statements from Will these many years, and it might come in a big box, or it might come in a PDF file or on a disk even. I've seen them come. But then you can at least have that information in front of you. And if you want to kind of avoid some of the future problems of this, John, you may actually want to just sell the shares. And depending on your gains and your situation, you may not have any tax liability on it whatsoever, because for people in the 15% and lower federal income tax brackets, long-term capital gains are taxed at 0% right now. And now that selling it may boost you up into the higher brackets, but I doubt that's the case. So look at that, then sell it. And then if you wait 30 days, you can go back in, put the same amount of money back into the shares again, and then you now have a new well-established cost basis, and you've got probably a higher cost basis, so you don't have to worry about having such a big unrealized gain in the future if you need the money, or if tax rates go back up on capital gains and you would have to sell it and then pay a higher tax rate.
You know, I also have a 401k with Vanguard, which has most of my money in there. Could I move that into the 401k? Is that
great question. The answer to that is no. What you can do is you can bump up your contributions, if possible, up to the limit, and then use the savings, the money that you've accumulated outside the 401k to live off of, to help offset the fact that you're going to have a smaller paycheck.
Thanks very much, John, for the call. Good luck to you. So if you have some confusing language on a financial, personal finance issue, you can call us, too, at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley, Certified Financial Planner, and this is On Your Money on the Ideas Network. And it is time now for Smart Assets. Can you buy a retirement home? Many retirees dream of buying their next home in some new or exciting or relaxing location, but there are a few questions that need to be answered before the purchase can be made. Kevin, what do I have to answer before I buy that condo in Tahiti?
Well, you have to answer this question. Are you doing this because you really want to move to Tahiti, or are you addicted to House Hunters International and you watch every single night?
A little bit of both.
A little bit of both, right? We have the On Your Money scientific correlation on House Hunters, especially House Hunters International, that the further north from which the potential buyers come from, all right, the more likely it is that they describe everything in the property as nice. if they're from Georgia and they're looking at a place in Belize, they might say it once or twice. If they're from Minnesota, Wisconsin, Michigan, there'll be five or six nices. And when those Canadians come down to Costa Rica to look at the condo, oh, this is nice. Oh, it's nice, eh? Look at the cabinets.
That's
these are nice.
Midwest nice. Yeah.
Yeah, it's gonna be nice. Oh, this is nice. Yeah, if you've got the bug, it's not to. Not to blame, because mortgage rates are low, prices are not near their all-time highs, and as House Hunters proves, it's very fun to shop. There might be some good tools that you should probably use to make sure that this goes as smoothly as possible, but try to take this on a less romantic tack and maybe a little more pragmatic, and you'll be much happier in the end.
Yeah, and I'm just kidding about the condo in Tahiti. I've never even been there. But where should we start?
Well, rather than buying, I would much rather have people interested in relocating or getting a second home rent first. There's less commitment of time and money, and it gives you a chance to establish kind of a home base, and then you can explore the area at your leisure while you're down there, rather than flying down and flying around for 2 or 3 days to quick look at properties, and then give yourself a test. You might end up renting in the end, because see how many times you think you're going to visit, how many days you're going to spend at this property, and then divide the annual cost of buying by that number of days you're going to spend there. So let's say you're going to spend $20,000 per year on mortgage payments, maintenance, taxes, insurance, wherever, but you're only going to be there, let's say 20 days, 3 weeks. That's $1,000 per night that you're going to be there. And for that price, you can get a really nice room or suite in a luxury resort, and it might be better off to just do that instead. But once you rent, you might say, you know what, renting is low cost, allows us to do just about everything we'd want to do with a home without nearly the expense, so you might end up just renting instead.
Yeah, I can see that being a good way to start. But what if, we still really would like to have our own place? We're still leaning towards buying.
You mentioned the condo. That's the great question, because the choice then is, do you want a condo or do you want a standalone property? The advantages of the condo are you have very low maintenance, less isolation. So when you're gone, there's hopefully somebody keeping an eye on the place. And for the money, you'll probably get a more ideal location with a condo than if you purchase a standalone home. However, versus a standalone home, you're not going to get nearly as good of lending terms with a home as you or with a condo as you do with a home. You're going to have a lot less room, especially if you're going to have company and family visiting you. You're going to have to pay those fees for the condo, for the maintenance, and then you have to deal with very near neighbors. You have to deal with a condo association, and for better or worse, you have less isolation.
So how do we go about paying for the purchase?
Borrowing is usually better for most people, especially if your only alternative is to pull a big lump sum out of a pre-tax retirement plan, because what you'll find is that if you take several hundred thousand dollars out of a 401k, you'll probably pay way more in taxes than you ever would in interest on the mortgage, especially if you're already in a higher tax bracket. Plus, you've given up liquid assets you could kind of do whatever you want with versus making a slow and low monthly mortgage payment. The key factor, though, is if you can do all of this and still stay below the bottom of the 25% federal income tax bracket. And in 2013, that's line 43 on your 1040, and it's at $72,500 for married couples filing jointly and half that amount for single filers. So if you can go into this place and either pull out a down payment or make a monthly mortgage payment and still not push you up into the 25% federal tax bracket, that's a better way to go. And then if you have a current home that you're eventually going to sell, maybe that's the time that you would then pay off the mortgage.
So anything else that prospective house hunters should consider?
Yeah, you might want to check to see if the place can actually be rented and if it can be rented by the day or the week or the month or even the year for a couple of reasons. One of which is it can help you offset the cost of ownership and get some money out of it while you're not using it. Or in the future, if you say, you know, we bought this place, but then the market went down and we really don't want to use it anymore, you can at least rent it out without having to use the rental cost to help offset the mortgage cost. Check with the zoning of the area, and then also check with the condo or the homeowners association if you're in a managed property.
Well, actually, I think it would be fun just bopping around looking for the houses in the different wonderful locations that you might want to live. That would be fun, too. Well, we are talking with Kevin McKinley. He's a certified financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money, LLC. About your personal finances. If you have a question, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Our next caller is Andy in Dubuque. Hello, Andy.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Yes. What's your question, Andy?
Hi. Yeah, I was listening to another radio station yesterday.
What?
Goodbye, Andy.
Now, they're talking about a new way to pay for college. You pay nothing while you're in school, and then after you graduate. I guess they're talking about this out in Oregon. They're debating it seriously. After you graduate from school, you pay back 3% of your salary that you make for 20 years. If you make a lot of money, then you're paying a lot for college. If you make only a little, you only pay a little. I was wondering what you think about that.
I think it's a great idea. But I love this kind of stuff on paper. And then, of course, when it actually is put into place, if it is put into place, all the messy details come out. I love it because it gives the school skin in the game. I love it because it means that something that parents and students are already doing, which is paying a percentage of their income for the long term in the future of paying education, the risk is more transferred on to the school. But that's also the bad news, too. First of all, you will see schools adjust to this and say, you know, we're not going to offer education on an esoteric basis. We're going to offer it based on, are you going to pay us back? The second thing that I think will happen is people who go to college and choose to be stay-at-home parents or non-working outside of the home spouses or whatever, are not going to pay into the system. So I want to see if they say, well, like, you know, if let's say two people meet in college, they get married, they have kids, and one parent chooses to stay at home. What does that parent pay for, because they're not earning any money technically? Is it going to be based on household income or whatever? So I'm very interested in it. I think that there'll be some unintended consequences that will be positive, and there will also be some that are negative.
Thanks very much, Andy, for the call. Coming up on this edition of On Your Money, a new versus a used car. Which one is right for you? Plus, more of your personal finance questions. 1-800-642-1234 or send that email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley, and this is On Your Money on the Ideas Network.
Mary's got a friend.
I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley, and we're going to talk about whether we should get a brand new set of wheels or whether we should get a used set of wheels during this portion of On Your Money. So we are working our way through this series, Kevin, and we finally reached the subject of buying a used versus a new car. I finally talked Rob, my husband, into getting a new car rather than a used. He was going to go with a used, at least in the shopping portion of this. And now he's decided he's just going to keep his jalopy for one more year. But anyway, what is the latest in this debate, Kevin?
Well, this is our most controversial topic, other than paying down a mortgage, is the new versus used car. And I think it's a credit to just how innocuous and boring the show actually is, that this is the kind of thing that really drives people crazy when we bring up this discussion. But the benefits, of course, of buying a used car is you're going to have a lower price up front. You'll have less depreciation. Typically, a car loses about half of its value or so in the first 3 years after purchase of a new car. But after 3 years, it only loses about 25% of the purchase price, the original purchase price in value over the next 3 years. However, with a new car, you get more predictable expenses, hardly any expenses if you pay cash for it. And if you do borrow, you get much better loan terms. You get a longer loan and you get a lower interest rate for it. And up until a few months ago, there was such a strong demand for used cars and such a low supply that it was actually a better economic decision to buy a new car than it was to try to find a used car. That's mitigated somewhat by the number of people who have purchased new cars. The demand for them is up in the last few months, which has equalized the process a little bit. But today we'll talk about buying a used car.
Oh, okay. All right. So where should we start?
If you are borrowing, you should not only get your loan pre-approved from your friendly lender, but also check your credit right now to make sure it's in good shape so that doesn't ruin the deal if there's a problem or your credit's not in good shape. And you can get a semblance of a free credit report at creditkarma.com, creditkarma.com, and we'll have a link up to that website at onyourmoney.com later on today. Otherwise, our good friends at Consumer Reports have a fantastic publication on used cars. It costs about $12. You can get it online. We'll have a link to it at onyourmoney.com, or you can buy it in the supermarket magazine stand. But there's 240 pages in there that not only has lots of different articles and things to look for with used cars, but also there's a review of almost every single model out there in terms of its year-by-year performance, problems that have come up with a specific model whatsoever. So just about any car you could possibly buy that's been produced in the last 10 years is in this. Once you've narrowed it down to a particular model, then you want to start shopping for that used car. And I would actually look for the dealers in your area who make, if you want to buy a Toyota, I would go to the Toyota dealership because they're not only going to know the vehicle better, but they're also likely to have the biggest supply of used Toyotas. You can also look online as well. And then, of course, go to Craigslist if you want. That can still be a very effective way to find a car, but you have to have your guard up.
All right. Well, we'll talk about that. And what do we do once we've found that prospective used car?
Check it out and check it out thoroughly. See if the seller has receipts for maintenance over time. You definitely want to take it not only for a long test drive in lots of different conditions and try out all of the switches and the air conditioning, shut it off, make sure the braking, steering, everything works, but then make an appointment with a mechanic to bring it in. Now, you're going to spend probably $100 or so to check it out, but the $100 can do a lot in terms of saving you potential headaches down the road and give you some bargaining report. You might want to get one of those Carfax reports as well. That's maybe $30 or $40, and that's not perfect. It doesn't cover a lot of things that can go wrong with a vehicle or that have gone wrong with it, but it's still the best thing out there. And then finally, make sure that the car not only has a up-to-date with any recalls that have gone by going to recall.gov and ask the seller, say, have you, you know, brought this in already to have the recall problem fixed, but also to make sure that it's not a flood damage vehicle. At any time we've had a lot of water problems on the East Coast or the southern part of the country, that produces a lot of flooded vehicles that kind of work their way back into the hinterlands here, and it can create a big problem for you if you end up purchasing one and you didn't know it.
Yeah. Just following up on that, Kevin, I have to admit I mostly always, in fact, always have gone to a reputable dealer to buy my used cars. Do I really have to drive that over to my friendly mechanic and keep it there for a couple hours while he checks it out?
Absolutely. This is something you are probably going to own. I'm willing to bet, Joy, that you probably own your cars for at least 8 to 10 years, right?
More than that. But
okay, so for a couple hours of your time and maybe $100 or so, it's definitely worth it just because you'll feel better about it and you'll find out a problem that will either prevent you having to pay for it down the road or give you some leverage in negotiations.
Okay, so it all checks out. Now what?
Now it's time to haggle, and if you are going to do a trade-in and you are doing it at a dealership and buying a used car, make sure you negotiate the price before you negotiate what the dealer is going to give you for the trade-in. Make those two separate transactions. Make sure you have, if you have the car checked out, make sure you bring in any problems and say, well, this is a fine car, but here's the things I found wrong with it, and on that basis I want the price lowered down to this dollar amount within reason or so. And the best way to get the best price on the vehicle is twofold. First of all, go there with a cashier's check, or if you roll this way, cash, for what you're willing to pay, for no more than that. And just say, look, here's the check, here's the money, I want it for this price. And if they say no, you have to be willing to walk away from it, because otherwise if you say, all right, I'm just kidding, what do you want to charge me for it?
Well, you mentioned getting a loan earlier. Do you still think a loan is better than cash?
Usually it is, depending on the interest rate. Now, if the only cash you have is money you would be using to purchase the car, I'd still rather have you get the loan and keep that money set aside for future issues. Or if it's the only way you can afford the car is to get a loan, you have no cash whatsoever, that's obviously the best way to go. You might want to try a credit union and see a local one and see what they have for rates and features and loans for used cars. Try to stay away from the actual car dealership. Typically, the loans offered there on used cars aren't the best deals out there. And homeowners who have some home equity established may want to consider using a home equity line of credit or a home loan or even getting a new mortgage. And as part of the proceeds, if they can't get a cash out, using it to help pay for the car if that's the only way they can do it. They'll get a lower interest rate. They may get a tax break on the interest, and they'll get a longer time to spread out the payments. And they can always pay it down early if they want with no penalty.
Well, we have a caller with a question about cars, so let's go to Barbara in Fort Atkinson. Hi, Barbara.
Hi. My question isn't so much whether to buy new or used. It's really more when. When is the car you're driving ripe for a trade-in? High mileage, do you drive it into the ground? Do you trade in while it's still pretty good? That's always been a confusion for me.
Yeah, I get that. And one of the things that I think is a common factor with many people in Wisconsin and public radio listeners is to drive those cars for a long time, drive them into the ground, and then once it's in the ground, start over with a new one. I would much rather have you, Barbara, purchase it when you're in a position of power, meaning your current car is working very well, there's no problems with it. If you do want to sell it, it's a good time to sell it. But more importantly, you're not then buying a new car in a panic. You're not saying, gosh, I need this car now, I need something to replace this, or you're not looking at a $2,000 repair bill on a $1,000 car. That's a difficult time to make a decision. So I'd rather have you say, you know what, everything's going really well right now, I think it's time to shop for a new car. And if you are buying a new car, this is a very good time of year to do it before, as they say, the new models come in.
All right. Thanks very much, Barbara. Good luck to you. Or you could do what I did. I traded in my used Celica, not to the dealer, but I gave it as a gift to my niece. And she drove it for 2 years, and she drove it into the ground. It only had about two more years left in it. And then we donated it to the Car Talk donation program, Kevin. And a portion, you know, went to benefit Wisconsin Public Radio. So that's an option for people, too.
And I think Mike Crane is driving it around right now. Isn't
he? He could be.
Is that how that works? I'm not sure. No, I don't think that's the case.
That's not how it works. You can see more details on the Car Talk vehicle donation program at WPR.org. Frank in Onalaska is with us. Hi, Frank.
Sure. This question going to follow up on your house hunter segment. I've seen a trend for owners of high-end real estate, you know, lake property, establishing ownership as an LLC or a trust. And I was wondering what the pros and cons of that are, given that they probably don't have a mortgage on it, so their only tax deduction is the real estate taxes. So why do they do this?
It's not so much about the tax break, because you're right, Frank, there aren't much in the way of tax break, unless it is an estate tax planning issue. It's twofold. If it's an LLC, it probably is, LLC stands for limited liability, and what they're trying to do is limit the liability for something that happens on the property to hopefully whatever value is within the LLC, which typically is just the property. They also might be doing it and setting up a trust as well to have it managed in case the original owners, something happens to them, they pass away or they become incapacitated, and they want to try to keep it in a family. They're setting up a legal structure already so that it can be effectively passed away or passed on before the owners pass away, and do it in a way that they've established while they're of sound mind and body, rather than trying to think about, say, okay, mom goes in the nursing home, oh gosh, what are we going to do with the place up north? Oh, well, my sister wants it. Well, no, she doesn't. And it can be really confusing. So I would recommend people with, like you say, a high value property, consider doing that while they are in good condition and can do it at their own pace rather than doing it in an emergency.
Thank you, Frank. A quick one from Alec in Wauwatosa. He sends this email. I'm a junior in college with loans from the government. I've gotten savings bonds for presents from my parents. For the bonds that have reached maturity, should I use those to pay for part of my loan now, or should I just let them sit?
That's a good question, Alex, and a tricky one, because if you cash it out, the good news is it's not earning any interest, so you're not losing anything by cashing it out. But the bad news is that if the loans are in your name, they may go on to your FAFSA form if you're applying for financial aid and may reduce your need-based aid. So all the things being equal, I prefer that you wait until you're done applying for financial aid and then cash them out at that time and then use the proceeds to pay off the loans. But keep in mind, you will probably pay taxes on the interest at that time, for better or for worse.
Okay, as our jam-packed edition of On Your Money comes to a close, we have time now for the website of the week.
A couple weeks ago, Joy, we discussed car insurance and all the different programs that many insurers offer depending on your situation, like discounts for a good student driver, etc. Bankrate.com put together a great chart of all the different discounts offered by all the different companies. We'll put a link up to that chart at onyourmoney.com later on today.
And we'll have more information next week on tips on buying a new car.
Yes, ma'am.
All right. We look forward to that. Four more words before we go.
Spend less, have more.
Kevin McKinley is a certified financial planner and the managing member of McKinley Money, LLC. He joins us just about every Tuesday for On Your Money. The program is now being repeated on Sundays from 7 until 8. I hope you stay tuned. There's much more to come. We will be hearing On Point coming up next. Alternative medicine, from herbs to acupuncture to supplements. That's coming up On Point after 9 o'clock. And coming up on Kathleen Dunn after 1 o'clock, Kathleen and her guest will talk about the delay in the implementation of the employer mandate in the Affordable Care Act. Thanks to Bill Martins and to Christy Taylor for producing this hour. Thank you for listening. I hope you stay tuned. There's much more to come. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.